back in 100 and whatever years ago, soaps were terrible. Heavy lye, terrible odor. All of a sudden, our founders created this wonderful soap. Pure white, great performance. It happened to float. And it was the number one brand, premium price, over a 50 or 60 or 70% market share. There's no data around. There was a study done in Sweden by this analyzer of medical history. And he determined that ivory was the greatest medical advance in history. And the reason is that all of a sudden people were actually bathing, which in itself reduced disease and disease transmission. Ivory was never changed. It never was changed over its entire history. And the market started to change. I believe had we responded, I bet it would still be viable today. There's no question. If you want to keep a brand viable, you have to continue innovating. Continue innovating. If you don't, it's not going to last.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Roman Segal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer. Roman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like being a fly on the wall for my mentoring coffees.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Gordon Brunner. We're going to be exploring the importance of things like quality, innovation, and leadership as discussed in Gordon's new book, Superior Product. Before we chat with Gordon, here's a short synopsis of the book. Superior Products is a unique first-ever coverage of the technical innovation behind the world's greatest leadership consumer brands, as well as the systems, culture, and leadership principles that produce the products and sustain innovation. Everyone pays lip service to the importance of product superiority, but words won't cut it. Product superiority must be demanded. It must be rewarded. It must be celebrated. And organization structures and processes need to be conceived and implemented to achieve it. This has to be led by senior line and R&D leadership, but importantly, also with the sitting with the CEO and board of directors. In the book, Brunner and James spent their entire careers encompassing 75 years in active research and top-level management of research and development at P&G, and that's what they discuss. This book, with its engaging stories of products we all use, will have broad consumer appeal, but also a particular interest to company executives wanting to establish an innovative culture. Now, before we jump into our conversation with Gordon, here's just a little bit more background on who he is. He was the P&G's chief technology officer, leading the company's technical community and even serving on the board of directors. At P&G, Brunner worked to create a system with rigorous standards, but in which both management and technical careers had a defined promotion path. In this system, P&G employees could choose between the path they desire, but also their success being measured according to the value they bring to either project management or technical initiatives that promote business progress. P&G still uses this two-pronged career path to this day. If you want more on Gordon's history and track record at P&G, listen to our previous conversation with them. But today we're talking about the book, Superior Products. So Gordon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Yeah. Well, the book, a phenomenal read, like the kind of description said, both for general users, but also, of course, for company executives and such. But before we jump into the content of Superior Products, I want to start with, you know, why write a book in the first place? Like, at least in my experience, it's not the easiest thing to do. It takes a lot of discipline and hard work, and there's a lot of long hours and stuff to it. So what was kind of the inspiration or motivation for you to say, let me take all of this experience and knowledge in my head and put it on paper?
Well, I thought about writing the book for some 25 years. I had a chance to have a marvelous career at Procter & Gamble. I realized that this is one terrific technology organization. Over its entire 187 years, it's been driven by superior products being the critical element for success. And I had a chance to live it. I was involved with the development of some 5 multi-billion dollar brands, some 20 different brands that are still on the market today. And I worked for four CEOs. I was on the board of directors. I had a chance to really see innovation at its best, how it got led, how it got executed, and how we worked to improve it to make sure it was long-lasting. You know, when you look at what's written about Procter & Gamble, there's a lot written about its leaders. There's quite a bit written about the marketing of its brands, because it is a great marketer. But there's nothing in 187 years that's been written about how these products were invented. And I thought to myself over this time, because you're right, it's a mighty daunting process to write a book. It's not for the faint-hearted. But I knew, because of the information I had, that if I didn't write this, it would be lost forever. There's no recording of it. There's no other way to establish what happened. And so I said, well, belly up and get it done. I involved Bill James, who was my chief of staff when I was head of R&D. Bill and I have known his entire career. In fact, I started a couple of years ahead of him, and I was his first boss. Our paths crossed in and out over those 40 years, but Bill became a real innovation expert. He also was head of human resources for the R&D organization, and he developed some really influential and unique paths for rewarding and progressing researchers in our company. And they've stood the time. So we had all this to talk about. I needed someone to bounce ideas off, because you realize that what you say and how you say it and so on needs to sort of get whacked in the head to make sure it's right. And so Bill and I joined to do this. It's been a real process. Actually, writing it was a lot easier than publishing it. But here we are. We're hopeful that it has a major influence on the whole innovative process, perhaps. But certainly, it'll be a great recording of some really great products.
Yeah, which, first of all, I think a really interesting thing to talk about. You're his first manager, and it's kind of an interesting thing. It's like, what would it be like to write a book with my first manager? Or are you a good enough manager to want your direct reports to want to write a book with you perhaps someday? Maybe that's a new way to think about your management style. But I love what you said about this idea of like, hey, this information wouldn't be out there otherwise, right? Otherwise, it would just be kind of completely lost to the ether. But by taking the time to put what was in your head and what your experiences was down on paper, now not only do you have the benefit to all of those people that, you know, gained from your insight and your leadership over the years and things that you all did while at P&G, now there's a whole another group of people and even a whole generation or possibly generations and generations of people that can learn from that because it's now in that written form. And I think, you know, part of our conversation today, we want to learn from the insights of the book itself, but also for other leaders out there, other people who have maybe done interesting things and maybe, you know, take some inspiration from this to say, you know, maybe there's a book that they have or another way to get that information out there, because I think such a great kind of way to recognize the value of getting those things there. So we'll talk initially about the content of the book, but how was the process, right? Was there anything that you loved? Were you mostly talking through things? Was it you sitting down at a old school typewriter and kind of typing it out? What was the actual process to go from these are the things in my head to this is boom, you know, just high level, boom. Now this is, you know, words you can read from a book.
Well, having thought about the process for all those years, there were a number of stories that I had riveted in my mind. I had documented in my mind the people involved, the issues involved, the challenges involved, and the stories flowed very, very easily. Others, it wasn't so clear. I knew it was a great story, but perhaps I didn't have all the key details, and I had to go back. I tried to go back with people who might be able to shed some light. Now, I happen to be an age that a lot of the people that I was engaged with were no longer around. Mm-hmm. But the whole process worked well. I only talked about things that I was involved in or Bill was involved. We didn't try to capture history about things that we didn't know a lot about. And fortunately, there were a lot of things we knew a lot about. So the process went pretty easily. If there was something wasn't quite sure what I wanted to say, I had a stenographer and I did a lot of dictation and back and forth. But other than that, I could type as fast as I could talk. And that's really what I did. It took me about 6 or 7 months to do the manuscript. And then the trouble, then it got hard.
Yeah, that's when, the publication process, et cetera. But it exists now. And like you said, you had plenty of information in the brain to go with, because I think it's a little over 300 pages, right? So a lot of insight. But I love that firsthand experience, right? You're not going to say there's a lot of innovation that happened at PNG, kind of prior to you being there, probably after you left, et cetera. But to say, no, this is what we know, so you can give that firsthand kind of account or experience, I think is a great way to think about things. And so far, I know it's only recently come out. Has there been any favorite moments or reactions or comments that you've gotten from people in terms of the, people having it now in their hands to see?
Well, it's early. Of course, people who were involved in these inventions are just thrilled to the moon. You know, they're so grateful that this got recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, great inventions have a lot of fathers. So the point being that a lot of people might feel that they were left out, that they should have been mentioned. If they worked on the project, they were important. And so that's a risk we knew we had to take. We try to address that right up front in the book, saying there's no way we could cover all the people involved, and there's no way we could cover all the organizations and functions that are involved. But we tried to do as good as we could, and recognizing that there will be elements of that we weren't able to fully grasp. Probably the toughest challenge we faced was the fact that we wanted photos.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 220 colored photos of products. And if you talk about products, you've got to have photos.
Yeah.
Well, these 220 photos, most of them were copyrighted by Procter & Gamble. Mm-hmm. Never in the history of the company, 187 years, have they released copyrighted photos to anyone but an advertising agency.
Mm-hmm.
That took me 2 months. And I understand. I understand this was a fairly big challenge to overcome. And I'm sure there were a lot of legal people that got involved in the whole process, but I got clearance.
There you go.
I got clearance to use these photos. And I'm so glad it did, because this book requires the connection between the story and the picture. Furthermore, I talk about things that didn't work or things that maybe we should have done differently. Well, Procter & Gamble's a great company, but Procter & Gamble doesn't really like to hear a lot about what we didn't do right.
Mm-hmm.
But it was okay. I didn't want to have any issue with Procter & Gamble. I love this company, and I've worked it. I mean, I've devoted my life to them. So I got through all that. I got through the whole thing with no reservations. But that took me almost 4 months.
Yeah.
And it was a tough process.
But I can, in some ways, I think the book, the fact that you're doing that level of, kind of diligence and making sure you got approvals and connecting with people, et cetera, it probably speaks to the fact that the goal with the book was to also release a superior book. Right. If you're going to do a book about superior products, you want the book to kind of match that same level of, standard in many ways. So the pictures help to tell that story, the connections, the, clearances or things that you need, covers it. And so, as we jump into some of the content and the lessons of the book, I mean, starting first with the title, why superior products versus, great products or really, really good products, like superior brings a certain connotation. And is that, central or core to the actual success? Is that it's not just that it's a good enough product, but that it is better than the others?
That's really critical. Right from the start, the founders and all the way through history set the goal that we're going to be involved in developing products that are consumer preferred. They're going to be seen by the consumer as better than anyone else. That was the challenge. And it's been consistent for the whole history of the company. When we've got a superior product, we probably raise the price and we market the heck out of it. That works. It works and it works and it works. When we have a parity product, something about equal, and we try to do the same thing, raise the price and market the heck, it struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're ever in a case where we have an inferior product, we got a disaster because we are one expensive marketer.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had some of those.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to be successful for 187 years, you got to be doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
And the strategy, superior products. We're going to have superior products. That's going to be our mantra. That's what's critical for our success is unique and very important. Could we ever lose it? Yes. Yes. And we've come close many times. People get theory that, you know, that's too hard.
Mm-hmm.
We can wave our arms and waggle our teeth and we can market this and it doesn't work for us. And so that was another element of what I was trying to do. I want to make sure that the company never loses track of the fact of what has been successful. We need great marketing. We need great product supply. We need great salespeople. But none of that really works unless we have a product that's really consumer noticeably better.
Which I think, you know, you've mentioned marketing a couple of times, and I think a lot of people think of, you know, at least in my time at P&G, I remember AG always being clear, like we are a marketing company that happens to sell consumer goods. So it's well known in terms of its marketing leadership. It's well known for its general leadership training and development of people. But I feel like it's not necessarily as known as an innovation company or a technology company. But at the very beginning of our conversation, you referenced it as, hey, P&G is a technology company. And so I guess, you know, in your role as chief technology officer, it sounds like innovation was partially crucial for that success. But what were you doing to make sure that it was success? And what are you proud of to kind of prove that you had that success as being an innovative technology company?
Yeah, well, let me say first that around your point, one of the real stories that left a marked impression with me was when John Smale became CEO in 1980. We had an internal magazine at that time called Moonbeams. And John Smale, as new CEO, gave an interview for that magazine. The first thing he said was, you know, we're known as a marketing company, but we're really an R&D company. Well, that rattled across the walls of Procter & Gamble. I mean, it was a watershed moment. But John really believed that. And, you know, I tend to be a bit biased, but it really is true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that stands out in my mind is as to the quality of the technology at Procter & Gamble was the fact that we won the National Medal of Technology in 1995. The National Medal of Technology, the U.S. National Medal of Technology, is the greatest award that the country gives to outstanding science and engineering. People like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, Edward Deming, Henry Ford, people with no question outstanding accomplishments. I looked at that situation. I said, you know, to Bill James, my co-author, and then my chief of staff, I said, Bill, look at these inventions we've got. Why don't we put together a proposal to the United States Medal of Technology Committee and tell them what we've done? And we did. And we talked about ultra-thin Pampers and Always and Tide with Bleach and 2-in-1 shampoo and Crest Harder Control. Honestly, we blew them away. I talked later to one of the members of the committee, and she said, we were just so blown away. Those are the words she used, by the strength of your technologies. It was just amazing. Well, this convinced me of the quality of technology we had at Procter & Gamble. It said to me, Gordon, you made a pretty good choice choosing this company. Because that's what I wanted. That's what I was hoping to do as a biochemical engineer. I wanted to work with a top technology company. Why work with Procter & Gamble? Well, I knew then that that's the reason I was. So it was a great accomplishment. And it really just underscored what I knew was the case. We really were a top technology company.
Yeah, that's an incredible honor. And it's one that, you know, I think oftentimes I'm familiar with, like, yeah, this campaign won Cannes, or this one has this, you know, Ad Age kind of reference, and there's a big article about it, et cetera. But I'd never heard that we won the National Medal of Technology seems like a really big honor and big deal. And like you said, helps to reinforce that, yes, incredible technology and innovation and R&D that goes into it. And you're mentioning some of the examples, like I think I have a little bit of an understanding, obviously, because I've worked there, but more on the IT side. But what innovation goes into something like 2-in-1 shampoo? Isn't it just combining, you know, you're taking a half of a bottle of one kind and half of a bottle another, and you put it all into the same bottle? What like actual innovation do we not even see to make something like that a superior product?
Well, this was one of the most fantastic technology achievements really of all times. And, you know, the fact that the consumer wanted shampoo with conditioner is pretty obvious. It was a definite consumer need, okay? Well, when you take a shampoo and a conditioner and combine them together, they interact, and you end up with something that doesn't clean or condition. Very, very tough. And it was worked on for years. And finally, the idea came up of taking silicone, which is a conditioner, put it in very, very small particles in a shampoo matrix, such that it was suspended. And as long as you had a high concentration, it would stay suspended. And so as the consumer shampooed their hair, the conditioner stayed suspended. As soon as the rinsing started, it broke out, the silicone deposited, and you had conditioning. You say, well, that's impossible. Yeah, it almost is impossible, but that's what it was. A fabulous achievement. It changed the game in the shampoo business, which was a low margin. Everybody could make it in a bathtub. All of a sudden, it was a real technology, and it drove our business. And of course, it created Pantene, which was the number one shampoo brand in the world. So it's a little more than a simple technology.
Yeah, then just combining those two things. And I think that to me is what I think is why telling these stories is so valuable, is because you look at certain P&G products and either they seem relatively simple in the sense of like, oh, you're just combining two types of soaps and shampoo and conditioner together. Or you think of something like Tide, right? That's been around forever. And so it's like, oh, it just must have been really good a long time ago. And now we just have the same thing. But I know in the book and part of our conversation before, because you also talk about the failures in the book. Why do some things work and why do other things not last? And so can you speak to it all, like how Tide has been able to be successful for so long? Is it because it's just a really good product and always has been? Or has there been innovation along the way?
Well, Tide is a great example because it's had maybe 100 major innovations over its history, and it keeps growing. It's pioneered technologies for cleaning, packaging, form, going all the way now to pods and sheets. And it keeps growing. It keeps growing in share. It's an amazing brand. And you contrast that with Ivory. Ivory was our number one brand as a company, an amazing breakthrough. You have to think back in 100 and whatever years ago, soaps were terrible. Soap bars were terrible. Brown, heavy lye, terrible odor. All of a sudden, our founders created this wonderful soap, pure white, great performance. It happened to float, and it was the number one brand, premium price, over a 50 or 60 or 70% market share. There's no data around. But there was a study done in Sweden by this analyzer of medical history. And he determined that Ivory was the greatest medical advance in history.
Wow.
And the reason is that people bathe. All of a sudden, people were actually bathing, which in itself reduced disease and disease transmission. Anyway, you have this great brand. It never was changed over its entire history. So when competitive brands came in the 1960s, Dove by Unilever, with adding moisturizing cream, all of a sudden the consumer liked the better mildness, the better feel, and the market started to change. Ivory was never changed. That'd be one I'd like to do over again. I wasn't around. I wasn't actually involved with it, but I would like to do it over again. Because I believe had we responded probably with a flanker, because we wouldn't have wanted to change the iconic brand, I bet it would still be viable today. But for a number of reasons, iconic brand, we don't want to be Coca-Cola and change our product like they did.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I don't want to be the guy that has to stand up to why did we change Ivory?
Yeah.
We didn't change. And today it's almost out of business. We just shut down the iconic plant in Cincinnati that produced it. Why? Because there's no volume.
Yeah.
So there's no question. If you want to keep a brand viable, you have to continue innovating, If you don't, it's not going to last.
I think it's such a great reminder, whether it's a brand or, you know, if you're a service provider, if you're a consultant, if you're, you know, working marketing, whatever it is, you have to keep on innovating. And I think one of the things you spoke to is kind of because what is a top innovation 1 year, the next year and the next 5 years or next 10 years or whatever becomes the default, right? Everyone else sees what you're doing. They're like, well, we got to at least do that. And so if you want to be that superior product, that it sounds like from the Tide example, it's constantly innovating. It's constantly leading kind of the category and new innovations, new technologies, et cetera. So I think a wonderful story and reminder to have that superior product, that innovation is really, really key. And so, you know, innovation, these are some of the success stories. And then obviously the lack of innovation, we can understand that. But there have to be also times where you are trying to innovate and then you're just not being successful. And so I know you talk about something around what you call the valley of death when it comes to innovation, which part of one of the challenges with innovation. Can you explain a little bit further what you mean by valley of death?
Well, I would say almost every major brand we have today faced a time in its history where there was real issues of why should we continue this? Why? Because we were facing major challenges. The one that comes to mind quick, well, there's a lot that come, but one to talk about is the technology behind our paper business, Bounty and Charma. The technology was involved, called a structured sheet. It basically was to change the whole paper-making process in a way that would create a three-dimensional structure in the sheet such that it could absorb water, moisture, and remain intact, and yet have acceptable dry properties of softness and so on. Well, it required a massive change in these huge paper mills at high speed. And so the milestones were not being met and millions of dollars were being put in. And I happened to be coming on to the project at that time because John Smale, I started working for John Smale, and John was involved in this. He said to me, Gordon, I don't think we ought to keep going on this thing. He said, I'm not going to put another couple $100 million in behind this thing. They keep missing. And that happened twice. Two times, the individual leading the project said, John, stay with us. Give us a chance. We'll get this thing done. He did. I call that a valley of death. But they got it done. And it's changed the game. You know, Bounty has been just a superior brand. It's maintained its technology for over 30 years. No one has touched it in 30 years. So you can understand what a major change that was to the paper business. So that's one example, but there are countless others where projects face that kind of challenge.
And so how do you know if something is a valley of death, right? That a valley that it is going to eventually go back on an upswing versus that it is, you know, just a resting point before you go even further down a cliff, right? Like, for example, I think of one of the other stories that you talk about in the book is Olestra, which I know went through a long change, lots of innovation. And so you might say, okay, did Olestra get to a point that it was actually just in a valley and you know, it was stopped there? How do you know, like, okay, I need to keep going because it is going to eventually go back upwards versus I should stop here and we should cut our losses?
Well, I don't know if there's a simple answer to that. I think it was easy to realize that the breakthrough with a zero calorie fat was a pretty major breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
It had all the properties of cooking and baking and everything, but yet it had no calories. So that in itself is just a level of technology that was hard to give up on.
Mm-hmm.
But we faced major regulatory challenges. How do you get this? How do you get this thing on the market? We tried as a drug, as a cholesterol-lowering drug. It didn't meet the objectives. We tried it as a take it home. You could just use it up to a third night. The FDA finally said, no, we don't think that's a good idea. We thought about margarine, because margarine is sort of more a really healthy butter substitute, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we aren't in the refrigerated food business. We don't want to do that. Finally, we get approval. Now, this took 25 years to go through this process. And we had to learn how to make this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a simple process. So we had to learn how to make it. We had to learn how to get it on approval by the regulatory authorities. And we had to decide where we wanted to go. Well, we've decided that a potato chip looked pretty good. Huge market.
Mm-hmm.
A zero calorie fat. Potato chip, I mean, pretty good idea. Frito-Lay jumped on and said, we want it.
Mm-hmm.
Huge, huge opportunity. And I happened to be on the board, and I remember the debates we had. And it's in the book, I talk about Ralph Snyderman, who was the head of medical affairs at Duke University. He said, ladies and gentlemen, he said, we got to be careful here. I think it'd be much better if we took the time to create Alestra as a health improver.
Mm-hmm.
Take the time and put it out in a product where you can really offer health benefits to physicians as a pre-prepared meal, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the contrast, the volume there and the time there with huge opportunity in potato chips, we went forward. Well, we were a sitting duck, if you will, for the food police.
Mm-hmm.
And so it draw Ralph Nader's spinoffs, created a lot of havoc for us and brought out every element they could against us. And Alestra's image got tarnished and we had to shut it down. So I personally believe we should have been successful with that product. All you could do is say, I think I wish we had, woulda, coulda, shoulda, but
mm-hmm.
it had to be one of the greatest technology developments of company history. A really fantastic achievement.
And so stepping back from that now, how do you think it could have been successful? Would it have been if you'd gone the course of kind of listening to this doctor and done kind of the prepared food, pre-prepared food side of things? Would it be better managing it coming out at a different time so that you don't have some of the negative kind of PR that came around with it? Is it rebranding the name into something else? Like, you know, any lessons that you can say, okay, is the lesson just, hey, sometimes you can put a lot of money and do it for 28 years and things still don't work out? Or is there, you know, other things that we can draw from innovation to try to, you know, mitigate any risk going forward?
Well, obviously, you know, there's no way of knowing, but I believe had we taken a tack to prove its health benefits to the medical community,
mm-hmm.
we would have created a platform that we could have stepped off of, whether that was a margarine,
mm-hmm.
because at that point in time, margarine and butter were under a lot of attack for heart disease and so on. Had we come out with something that really gave a major benefit towards cholesterol reduction and absence of clogging of arteries,
mm-hmm.
and then moved into potato chips, I think we could have been successful. So that's the thought I have. We'll never know whether that would have worked.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and like you said, that it's the woulda, shoulda, could-haves of the world. And I think that's always going to exist with innovations. Along the like the should-haves, I know, you know, in the book you talk about some of the major R&D advancements, not just on products themselves, but also on the structure of the organization of how you do things. So things like the internal company new venture program, or, you know, moving from the secret working environment to more open innovation. I mean, of those, is there one, connect and develop, et cetera, is there one that you think stands out as a particular innovation in terms of the structure or the capacity of innovation that you think is particularly has had a lot of impact or success?
Well, certainly the most radical structure change we undertook was the venture program.
Mm.
You know, at that point in time, the venture opportunities broadly in the country were major. People with an idea were getting funded, hitting milestones and bringing ideas forward. Well, here we have a huge company, 100,000 people, very structured, and we decided we're going to try to create an internal venture program. We've got all these bright people. We got the brightest people in the world. Why don't we open it up and say, if you have an idea that's quite different than an area you work on, but you have an idea of creating a major new product, come and tell us about it. Come and tell us, the CEO and myself were involved, and we'll listen to it. If it's an idea we want to fund, we'll give you the structure, the people, the money to pursue it. That's what we tried. Mm-hmm. It was really radical. Well, the ideas that came forward were just mind-blowing. People with real passion. And, you know, that's how we created Febreze. That's how we created Swiffer and Thermacare and Glad bags, which we've subsequently licensed to Glad, but putting odor and flexibility into plastic products. And on down, I think out of the total we started, you know, Mr. Clean Car Wash and Tide Cleaners. And we moved a lot of things forward, and it was great. Hard to do, you know, hard to do because it required real leadership at the top. Dirk Yager was the CEO, and he was willing to do this. He would be willing to stand up for anything if it could create a major new idea, and he did. That was great. Well, I retired. Dirk Yager left. Whole things fell apart. Okay. People took credit for all the ideas we invented and shut down the system which created them. That's really what happened. Mm-hmm. But was it successful? Yes. Was it easy? No.
Yeah.
Could it be done again? Yes. Is there tremendous potential amongst P&G people to do this kind of thing? Absolutely. Okay. New brands are tough. They're the hardest thing to do. Mm-hmm. And in a book, I talk about the fact that the most successful we ever been at creating new brands throughout the history of the company was when the CEO was in close contact with the people doing the work. You go back to all the way back, every John Smale and before that, Ed Harness and so on, Dirk Yager. That's what happened. When you delegate new brand development off to somebody on the side, which is the common way to do it, it doesn't work. It absolutely doesn't work. I've never seen it work. Mm-hmm. But it takes tremendous commitment on the part of the CEO to do that.
Yeah.
But on course, the other end, that's what it takes. It's hard. I mean, you need that reinforcement, decision-making, support. All the above to really make it happen.
Yeah, and that willingness to get through the valley of death, to recognize that it can be just a valley. And I think, you know, what you're speaking to is, and what I appreciate about the book is, again, it's not just the individual product stories. It's not just what happened with Tide that's been good or what happened with the Lester, but it's a structure to create it, right? So for people listening that want to be a more innovative company, that want to bring that kind of style into it, is recognizing that it's not just the product that has to be superior, it has the organization in a way needs to foster it and support it. And like you said, it's not at all easy, but it is important, right? In terms of giving people that space to be able to try new things. I imagine it's incredibly empowering too, to be like, hey, I have this idea that's very different. I mean, I experienced it at P&G on the more soft skills side of talking about, you know, was a project manager by day, but then started teaching the value of humor and communication, or bringing a little bit more fun and levity into your work to get success. But the fact that that was enabled at P&G, that the management structure, the leadership structure was to enable those ideas of individuals, made me much more engaged, excited. And I can imagine it probably does the same thing for someone on, you know, an R&D side of having innovation. So, you know, part of that leadership is creating the culture and the structure to support innovation, it seems like.
No question. The whole environment attitude towards innovation in the company was never higher. A good example is Febreze and Tuan Trinh, who was a young a chemist who came up with the idea and painted what could be done. This made his life. Okay. I mean, this created, he was just with me a week ago. What an achievement. I mean, how can a single individual come forward with an idea and create a $5 billion business? Okay. Steve Jobs can do it, but Tuan Trinh, a Vietnamese chemist, can do it. Mm-hmm. And he did it. And that's what happened.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Well, this and many more stories, lessons, insights, failures, et cetera, are all in the book. And so if you've enjoyed that, enjoyed our conversation, for those of you listening, definitely check it out. You can pick it up on all major online sellers, which Amazon, et cetera. There's the hardcover I recommend, because as you mentioned, so many beautiful, great pictures. So that's kind of the best way to pick it up, I think. So encourage that, you know. And since we've got to wrap up soon, we like to end all of our conversations with a kind of quick answer round. So given that we're talking about books, I would say my first question for you. So you've written a book. In addition to Superior Products, what's another book that you might recommend to people to check out, whether in the space of innovation, leadership, something that's resonated with you?
Well, the John Smale book, Here Forever. You know, John Smale was a mentor of mine. He was probably the greatest company leader, maybe of all time. At least that's my view. Mm-hmm. He was chairman at General Motors, did some great things there. But that book, Here Forever, is a marvelous, marvelous book. And Ed Arce's book on globalization of R&D, globalization of the company, is another great book in my mind. Obviously, I'm talking about Procter & Gamble, but that's my life, okay?
Yeah.
But, you know, other than that, you know, I love Steve Jobs' book. I particularly like the one he wrote. Mm-hmm. I think Elon Musk's book, Isaacson's book, is a fantastic book. I relate to these books because they bring home to me exactly the kind of situation that I faced and was lucky to face in the career I had at Procter & Gamble.
Yeah. And like we said at the beginning, the value of even a book like Superior Products is, not only did it benefit the people going through all those experiences, but now many of us can, you know, who maybe had no connection or relationship to these products or didn't know that we won the National Medal of Technology, et cetera, start to learn those lessons and those stories, but more importantly, the insights and stuff that we can now apply to our own work. And so,
Drew, I'd maybe add one other thing of importance to the whole process, and that's the reward structure. Mm-hmm. When you have great researchers, you know, you want to motivate them. You want to drive their output. This was a frustrating thing for me because we had great innovators, but we had no system by which anybody knew who was great. Mm-hmm. They all were well paid. They couldn't wear their paycheck on their forehead, you know. And so we reached, and Procter & Gamble had never in its 160 years, whatever it was at the time, had never had a system whereby we ever acknowledged anybody except a manager. Mm-hmm. That was a tough thing to crack. Well, we decided, no, we're going to try to change that. We created a society. We named it the Vic Mills Society after probably the greatest inventor in Procter & Gamble history. Well, no researcher has any greater reward than be recognized by his peers. Mm-hmm. And that's what it allowed it to do. And our opening ceremony, presenting the gold medal to these people with their families in the convention center at Procter in Cincinnati, was the greatest thing that I can ever remember. It was absolutely standing ovation, almost better than any Academy Award ceremony that I've ever seen. And there have been some pretty lousy ones recently, but but in the past, so it really changed the game. And when we did that, I thought, well, we got approval for doing this, but I thought every other function was going to say those lucky guys, they got special treatment and so on, blah, blah, blah. Quite the opposite. Never any complaint. What happened? All the other functions created their own societies.
Yeah.
And it changed the game at Procter & Gamble. It changed the importance of of skills. If you want to be the best marketer, you can actually be known as the best marketer. You don't have to be a vice president of an operation. So that was a real pivotal thing at Procter & Gamble. It still is. I get letters from people in other functions who say it changed their whole career. It gave them an opportunity to do what they wanted to do without having to become, you know, a manager of other people. So,
yeah. Well, I think it's wonderful to hear the story creation of that, because I remember at my time at P&G, it already existed. And so when people are like, hey, you have these two tracks, you can kind of go down and here's recognition and other, it's like, oh, that makes total sense. But that's not how it is in every other organization, and certainly not how it was in the past. So I think it goes back to how are you building the structure to create an innovative culture, to create an innovative team. And part of that, a big part of that, is recognition. And so I think it's a wonderful thing to call out and kind of make sure to emphasize that goes into it. That's how you create these superior products long-term, as you support the organization to be able to do so. So Gordon, just as we close, we always close with the same last question. If you were to give one final piece of advice to the next generation of leaders, what would it be?
If you're a leader of a company and you want innovation, you got to recognize you have to lead it. You have to mandate it. You have to make sure that this is a key strategy for the organization. You have to support it. But delegating innovation in a company just doesn't work. It's too tough. It's a hard process. Nobody really wants to take risky projects. It's just as easy to get promoted if you don't have to do as much. So you have to really make it, demand it. And fortunately for Procter & Gamble, for the most part, over its entire history, it's had that kind of leadership. Not always, but for the most part, it's had that leadership, and that's what's made it successful. But it's essential.
Fantastic. Fantastic piece of advice. Gordon, thank you so much for the conversation today. Again, if you're listening to this, check out the book, Superior Products on All Online Retailers. And thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you, Drew.
And that's our show. Like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Andrew Tarvin.
And I'm still Roman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.